This is the takeaway for Wednesday, July 5th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. And while Americans everywhere were enjoying the rocket's red glare on the 4th of July at the Pentagon and the State Department and the White House, they were dealing with rockets of another kind. The North Korean government of Kim Jong-un claimed, and it was later confirmed, to have launched its first intercontinental ballistic missile capable of reaching U.S. territory. Before the launch last week, President Trump signaled he was about to get tough with the North.
The era of strategic patience with the North Korean regime has failed. Many years, and it's failed. And frankly, that patience is over.
That was President Trump at the White House with South Korean President Moon Jae-in last week. The United States participated in a naval show of force in response with the South Korean military yesterday. Still, it's unclear what America's options are here if its patience is in fact over with North Korea. Here to explain what is currently known about the missile that North Korea launched and what our options might be is David Wright. He's co-director of the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. David, welcome to The Takeaway.
Nice to be here.
You are a physicist, right?
That's right.
If you were advising President Trump from a science perspective on this missile, on this launch, and what it says about North Korea's capabilities, what would you tell him?
Well, I would tell him that what we saw was something of a surprise in the sense that it happened pretty quickly after a previous launch, but that it's basically the next step in what missile engineers would do to try to increase the range of North Korea's missiles, and that we can expect that to continue. They clearly have the capability to keep building longer and longer range missiles and put nuclear weapons on top of them. So I would argue that something needs to be done now if they want to cap that capability.
Well, this was hailed as kind of a grave milestone, not only by North Korea, but by other countries, including the United States, who were observing here. Is it a real milestone? And if so, why?
You know, from a technical point of view, as I said, I think it's sort of the next step in what we have seen them being developing. So I would say it's not so much of a milestone technically. From a symbolic point of view, I would say it's a big deal to the United States. It's the first time that North Korea has had the ability to launch something that has the capability of reaching U.S. territory in the way that this one did. This could cover basically all of Alaska. Can't hit the west coast of the United States yet, but I think symbolically that's going to be a big deal.
Is that all you need, a rocket that can reach Alaska or California? I mean, what does it take to put a nuclear warhead on the tip of that missile?
Well, so the first thing you need is a missile that has the range. And then, as you say, the next thing you need is a warhead for it. We've seen North Korea over the past number of years do five underground nuclear tests. So they have the ability, and those tests have been showing, you know, more power. So we've seen that they have the ability to get a nuclear explosion, at least in a controlled situation. And then the question is whether they can make that small enough and rugged enough to put on a ballistic missile. There's some debate about that, but I think most experts believe that they're either at that point or are, you know, closing in on the point where they'd be able to do that.
So, David Wright, you said at the top, if you were advising President Trump, you would tell him that this all means that intervention is required now. Because of North Korea's march on the technology here. What does deterrence mean now that they have this bigger ICBM? Experts used to say, well, if we detect an imminent launch or rockets being fueled, we should be ready to strike with planes or with missiles. Is that operable anymore? What does it mean to do something now?
So I think that Kim Jong-un is despicable, but I think he's also rational. I think he is deterred. I don't think that he would wake up one morning and decide to fire a missile because he knows it would lead to retaliation that would destroy his country and his regime. So I guess there's two things. One, that I'm worried about is just as tensions ramp up and sort of the bellicose nature continues to increase, that there could be an accident, there could be a miscalculation, there could be something that causes an incident that is a disaster. The other thing I would say is that the Trump administration, like other administrations, realizes that there's no good military option for solving this problem. We don't know where all of their military facilities are. A lot of them are underground. And even if we attacked, that would likely lead to a conventional artillery attack on Seoul, which would be devastating. You know, Trump has wanted sort of appealed to China to fix this, but China's position for many years has been that this is fundamentally an issue between the U.S. and North Korea, and that those are the countries that are really going to, in the end, have to sit down and solve this. So my advice would be to find a way to sit down with North Korea, start informal talks to figure out how to lower the temperature and hopefully move forward.
So talks sound possible, David, right? They've been tried by multiple administrations in the past. I have to say that what you're describing, the different options, none of them sound like they're very good at this point.
Well, I would have to agree. And I think that's what sort of every administration has found with North Korea is there are no options that jump out as being, particularly enticing. But I think the idea of trying to engage with North Korea is the best one. And I think one thing that's been clear is that China and probably Russia, who are North Korea's sort of biggest backers, would support that. And so I think there's international support for moving forward with this that might make things better.
David Wright is co-director of the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Dr. Wright, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as the White House is dealing with North Korea's new missile capabilities, President Trump is headed to Poland today. And at the end of the week, he's scheduled for a one-on-one meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Back home, Republicans and Democrats are increasingly worried publicly that the president isn't taking seriously Russia's effort to undermine the 2016 presidential election. President Putin has denied any interference in the 2016 elections, but an assessment from the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, and others say that they have no doubt that Russia interfered to try and help candidate Donald Trump. Nicholas Burns was one of those who testified at a Senate hearing last week on Russia's election meddling in the United States and in Europe. Nicholas Burns is a former ambassador to NATO and undersecretary of state for President George W. Bush. He's currently a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Ambassador, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much.
Ambassador, you've been very critical of both President Obama and President Trump for not doing more to prevent or respond to Russian election meddling, both in Europe and here in the United States. What do you want to see President Trump do when he meets with Vladimir Putin at the G20?
Well, I think President Trump has to raise this issue with a great deal of strength and conviction because Russia launched a cyber attack against the United States elections last summer and autumn. President Obama reacted slowly to it, but he did sanction Russia. He did have a one-on-one meeting with Putin where he warned Putin of the consequences of this type of action for the United States. President Trump, on the other hand, has done absolutely nothing. He's not launched an investigation of his own. He has not supported sanctions against Russia. He's not even asked his primary cabinet officials to work on this issue. So his inaction has given the play to the Senate. The Senate voted 97-2 to impose new sanctions on Russia. I think that President Trump must raise this issue with President Putin to defend the United States, to defend our democracy, and to show Putin that this kind of action isn't going to be tolerated.
What would consequences look like that might be a good deterrent for the future here, both in the short term, maybe in this very conversation between President Trump and President Putin, and then in the longer term?
I think the most immediate consequence by the United States would be the voting of sanctions by the House and Senate. The Senate bill was overwhelming in support. The House has gone slowly on it, and that the Trump administration is lobbying the House to maybe not even proceed, I think that would be a great mistake. If we hesitated to enact sanctions against Russia in response to this flagrant violation of our democratic elections, it would be a victory for Putin. It would encourage him because we do have the 2018 midterms right ahead of us. We have the 2020 presidential election on the horizon. And unless we can show the Russians that there's going to be a response, there's every reason to believe that Putin might do this again. And I think President Trump could do something else, and that is to work with state and local governments. They run the elections in the United States to try to strengthen our defenses because we know the Russians were able to penetrate the databases of 21 American states. We don't know what effect they had, but we know they had the intent. This is about as serious an issue as it can possibly be for a democracy, and I do think that President Trump has failed to lead and failed to defend us.
But Nick Burns, isn't so much of this issue seemingly tied in with the president's own perception of his narrow electoral victory? We've seen report after report of the president in private meetings assuring other politicians that he won the popular vote, or illegal people voted, that's why he lost, or that Russian meddling is a hoax or it's fake news. How big of a problem is this, that this issue of global diplomacy and our adversarial relationship with Russia seems to be something that hasn't really permeated the personal consciousness of the president at all?
I think this psychological barrier is probably the answer to what is bothering President Trump. He believes, apparently, that if he's tough on Russia over the interference in our elections issue, he'll agree with the presumption that the Russians were interfering in order to help President Trump defeat Hillary Clinton. That's what the U.S. intelligence agencies concluded when they made their public report to the American people in early January of this year. And President Trump just has to get beyond that, because his primary responsibility is to defend our country, to advance our interests, particularly against another country, an aggressive adversary, Russia, that's trying to do us harm. He needs to get beyond that. And if he can't, it's going to continue to bedevil his presidency and weaken his presidency.
And if you put yourself inside the mind of Vladimir Putin now, and you watch the president and the Senate and the American news media deal with this issue, you're going into this meeting with Donald Trump. What are you thinking?
President Putin wants to develop a relationship with President Trump, try to entice President Trump into some kind of bilateral relationship where we release the sanctions, we weaken the sanctions in return for Russian cooperation on Syria or on North Korea. It'd be a very bad trade for the United States. Putin's experienced leader. He's been in power now for 18 years. He is wily and cynical. And so President Trump really has to be on guard here. And his advisors in the room, General McMaster, the National Security Advisor, Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, need to counsel the president to be clear, tough-minded, because Putin is a very able adversary.
Ambassador Nick Burns, thank you for joining us once again.
Thanks very much.
Ambassador Nicholas Burns is a former ambassador to NATO under the administration of President George W. Bush, currently a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. There are some new rules coming out of the Veterans Administration designed to make it easier for vets to get emergency treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Not every veteran leaves the military with a full honorable discharge, but that doesn't mean they have dishonorable discharges either, and that gray area can keep many vets from having access to care. Christopher Goldsmith is an Iraq War veteran and Army sergeant who served from 2004 to 2007. He was released from the Army with what's called a general discharge, following a suicide attempt that left him hospitalized and unable to deploy. Christopher was able to get care that he says saved his life, but many other veterans who served and got wounded in war are at risk of being left out.
I missed my deployment. They counseled me. Again, I was never charged with a crime. It was basically like getting a write-up at work for not getting on the plane while I was handcuffed to a gurney in the hospital after surviving a suicide attempt.
A suicide attempt related to your service in the first place?
Yes. I was eligible for VA benefits. There's honorable, general, other than honorable, bad conduct discharge, and dishonorable. I got a general discharge. And a lot of people complain about the VA, but VA doctors saved my life. Northport VA Medical Hospital in Long Island, where I grew up and where I returned to after the Army, really did save my life, because they went above and beyond to save me when I was in a state of crisis for a period of years. So my fight is to make sure that all of the veterans and the vast majority of veterans with bad paper have been denied health care. The VA has identified 505,000 veterans who are alive today who've been denied access to health care, some of them for as long as 50 years. I'm fighting to make sure that they all get the same access to recovery that I did.
So let's talk about this new benefit that the VA is bringing online now. It was first announced back in March, mm-hmm. allowing veterans with this so-called bad paper, if they're in crisis, presumably from PTSD, they can go and get emergency counseling. Mm-hmm. It lasts for 3 months. Do I have it right?
Yes.
So what does this benefit mean to vets that you know who have bad paper? Is it enough? Does it really help them in the problems that they have?
So Secretary Shulkin, he was a physician first. He really believes in the oath to do no harm. And that's why he went ahead and went ahead of the administration and Congress and said that any vet who is about to die by suicide is going to have, of course, access to emergency mental health access. Now, he didn't need a law to do this. It's the VA's own regulation that has stopped this. The 1944 GI Bill of Rights protected veterans from being booted out of the military without access to health care. They had to be found guilty through a trial. For these administratively separated veterans, and there are tens of thousands from my generation alone, there's no due process at all.
So in this case, though, we're talking about some new access, but we're really talking about emergency access when a vet is in crisis. We're not talking about ongoing counseling or preventative care or anything like that. We're talking about if you're on the edge, you can go ahead and come on in.
Yes. You know, while I appreciate Secretary Shulkin changing the rhetoric, frankly, it's not enough. It's putting a Band-Aid over a gunshot wound. What veterans want and what veterans deserve is for the House and the Senate Veterans Affairs Committees to hold hearings on the topic of bad paper discharges. We just found out from the Government Accountability Office last month that 62% of veterans who were kicked out of the military with bad paper had been diagnosed with PTSD, TBI, or related conditions before getting kicked out. So they're taking people who they know are disabled and then denying them things like health care and the GI Bill.
Christopher, you mentioned a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound, these new rules at the VA. But do you have some hope that the new rules will help some vet like you or some group of vets like you in crisis who can now go and get help? Do you think at least it's going to make a difference in keeping some vets alive? Because it sounds like that's the point.
The new rules will absolutely save lives. I don't want to sound like I'm criticizing Secretary Shulkin. He deserves a lot of credit for going out ahead on this. But this is not enough. We need to do more. If a veteran with PTSD or traumatic brain injury or who suffered military sexual trauma can't get counseling on a regular basis before they've reached that crisis point, are we really doing any justice here? Or is that just a slap in the face? The secretary has gone as far as he can without top cover from President Trump and without the support of Congress. We need everybody, and we need the average voter to get engaged on this issue and say that every single veteran who has PTSD deserves access to mental health care.
Christopher Goldsmith, Iraq War veteran, Army sergeant, served in Iraq 2004 until 2007. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
Christopher Goldsmith works as Assistant Director of Policy at the Vietnam Veterans of America and is also the founder and president of the High Ground Veterans Advocacy Group. In Washington now, where a federal appeals court issued a blow to the Trump administration's environmental agenda earlier this week. The court blocked the Trump administration from delaying rules aimed at curbing methane emissions from oil and gas wells. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt has been working to undo many environmental regulations set down by the Obama administration, but Monday's decision suggests it won't be easy for the new administration to roll back regulations through delays. Lisa Friedman is a reporter on the climate desk for our partner, The New York Times, and she joins me to explain this methane rule and why it's only the start of a long battle.
The methane rule requires oil and gas companies to detect and fix any leaks in their operations. Methane is a potent greenhouse gas. It accounts for about 11% of emissions in the U.S., but it really packs a punch of warming. So this was a key part of former President Obama's climate change efforts, and it was one of the many that Scott Pruitt had in his crosshairs when he entered the EPA.
Well, new administrations usually get the right to write the rules the way they want to. Why did the court say that in this case, the EPA under Scott Pruitt can't do it?
Sure. I think it's important to note that the court didn't exactly say that the administrator cannot revise this rule or rescind this rule. What the court said was that there's a process. Administrator Pruitt had delayed the rule first 90 days and then 2 years while he sought to likely repeal it. And what the court said is that you can't just suspend the rule while you're hoping to repeal it. That is, in the court's words, tantamount to revoking the rule.
Are there other rules besides this methane rule that are at stake here?
The Interior Department has similarly delayed a rule that would have regulated methane on tribal lands and federal lands. It's possible that that rule will come under the same scrutiny that this EPA rule did.
We should mention, while we're on that topic, Lisa, that Republicans in Congress wanted to undo that methane rule at Interior that you're talking about, until John McCain and a couple of Republican senators a few weeks ago shocked the administration and Republican leaders by voting it down.
Yeah, it was a pretty stunning rejection. The lawmakers were trying to use the Congressional Review Act to reject the resolution. And while some senators, like Senator Graham and Senator Susan Collins, had let it be known that they would vote against that legislation, John McCain's vote came as quite a surprise.
One that Takeaway listeners might remember was visually available, as Republican leaders got a shock when John McCain voted it down and kind of walked away on the Senate floor. Well, Lisa Friedman, where do we go from here?
Well, this was a huge victory for environmental groups, no doubt. This was the first major legal setback for the EPA. It said very clearly that the administration cannot just take matters wholly into their own hands, that there's a process that they're going to have to abide by. But I think it's also important to remember that there are a lot of regulations and rules that have been either delayed, revoked, or on the way to being repealed. And there's going to be dozens, if not hundreds, of legal fights ahead on virtually all of them. One thing to look at in the weeks ahead is the repeal of the Clean Power Plan, which is the Obama administration's signature measure to address climate change and to curb emissions from coal-fired power plants. We've been awaiting the repeal language, and that's expected out soon.
Lisa Friedman, reporter on the Climate Desk for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Wayne County is about 60 miles south of Savannah in eastern Georgia. And at first glance, Wayne County doesn't seem like the kind of place that would harbor a wave of environmental activism. The county is heavily Republican, very conservative, and not really the place where people lash out against, say, coal-fired power plants. But the area is also filled with rivers and wetlands. So when a local newspaper found out about a big company's plan to dump toxic coal ash into a town landfill, the paper and the people fought back. Dink Neesmith is the chairman of the board and the owner of the Press Sentinel in Jessup, Georgia, the local paper that spearheaded the story. And also here, Georgine Augustin. She's a reporter for Inside Climate News who covered the efforts in Wayne County. Dink explains how the paper found out about the story.
A friend of our reporter, Derby Waters, stopped by. Neil Herring, who is with the Sierra Club, noticed a legal ad about a rail spur application under a name none of us recognized. He stopped by and mentioned it to Derby Waters. We jumped on it and found out Central Virginia Properties, LLC, is a subsidiary of Republic Services, which owns a large private landfill in Wayne County. And that's what got us started 9 days into the 30-day public comment period of the Corps of Engineers.
And it turns out Republic Services was who?
Republic Services is the second largest waste hauler in the country. And if you dig a little deeper, you find out that Bill Gates has a 30% investment in Republic Services. So Republic Services' largest shareholder is the world's richest man.
And so your reporters got to work on this dink, and it turns out the whole point of that rail spur out to the landfill was so that Republic Services could haul tons and tons of coal ash to dump it there in town, right?
Based upon their application to the Corps of Engineers, they were talking about 100 rail cars per day or 10,000 tons per day of toxic coal ash to be dumped into their private landfill in our community.
What were people in town saying when they found out about this?
In my 68 years, I've never seen my hometown as upset. It's been a real grassroots rebellion to see what we can do. But so many people in the beginning, included so many politicians and elected officials, said, there's nothing you can do. They have a contract. And I said, well, hold on. Let's see about that.
Georgina Gustin, Dink says that folks said, well, they have a contract. There's nothing you can do. Why couldn't people in town just turn to the county or the state regulators and say, hey, you know, this is pollution. Put a stop to it.
Well, this is entirely legal. Under EPA rules, coal ash can be disposed of in a landfill. So because of some contracts that the county had signed with Republic Services and because of the EPA rules around coal ash, there was really no way to stop them until this community just really raised a lot of concern and started digging in and finding out what exactly coal ash could do and how it would impact the environment and public health in Wayne County.
Well, what can coal ash do that's such a problem?
Well, that's the kind of irony of this. The EPA says that anybody living near a coal ash disposal area has 2,000 times the cancer risk that the agency deems acceptable. And yet, the agency doesn't consider it a hazardous material and made a ruling to that effect and published it in 2015. So the agency doesn't consider it hazardous, which means that the highest, strictest standards for disposal don't apply to coal ash.
So Dink Neesmith, knowing all this, I take it a lot of the folks who read your paper in Wayne County weren't interested in being the test case for this loophole in coal ash dumping rules. What did you do with your paper when you realized this was going to be a war?
We went to war. Information is a powerful tool, and we gathered all the information we could, and we said right away that this is a situation where we don't want to be the albino lab rat to find out how much coal ash, toxic coal ash, can you dump in one place, especially on top of our sensitive wetlands, which drain to the Atlantic Ocean just 40 miles away. So we published three special ad-free editions of our newspapers. We published more than 75 stories. I personally wrote 62 columns on this subject, and we commissioned a freelance cartoonist to do more than 70 cartoons about this one issue. And we contacted Republic, we contacted Bill Gates, we contacted the 39th President of the United States, Jimmy Carter. We spun our old-school Rolodex to see who can we talk to about this. And the grassroots rebellion rose up, and we were able to slow this process down.
So, Dink, what was the tipping point here? You got your reporters on this. You hired cartoonists. You devoted your paper to stopping this dumping, and it sounds like you devoted your own column inches to it, too, writing over 60 columns yourself. When did you realize that things were tipping in your direction here?
When the Corps of Engineers extended the public comment period twice and gave us 90 days to build steam, I just felt that there's no right way to do a wrong thing. It was very wrong what Republic was attempting to do. And so I threw my heart into the fight first, and then my wallet followed. We raced to find a team of environmental attorneys that could help us, who could work with the Corps. And so within the first 5 days of knowing about this, we had a legal team on our side. And the longer it stretched out, the better the odds became.
Georgina, how many communities across the country are there where coal ash is going in, maybe to a similar landfill, but they don't have a press sentinel and they don't have a Dink Neesmith to sound the alarm?
Well, that's the big concern. Wayne County was saved by this crusade, by this shoe leather reporting, and this huge effort by this community. And the fact is, we don't know how many communities coal ash is being dumped in because until 2015, it wasn't regulated. So essentially, we have no idea. And already in Wayne County, there's been 800,000 tons dumped at the Broadhurst Environmental Landfill. That came from a utility in Jacksonville, Florida. So that's an unanswerable question. Hundreds of millions of pounds, potentially.
A plan to dump thousands of tons of coal ash into Wayne County in southeastern Georgia stopped by citizens and by the Press Sentinel newspaper. Dink Neesmith is chairman of the board and the owner of that paper in Jessup, Georgia. Also, Georgina Gustin, reporter for Inside Climate News. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'll write a list of all the books that I want to read.
Did you read that?
I did. Did you read that thing?
Yeah. Did you read?
Uh-huh.
Did you read?
Mm-hmm.
Did you read?
Of course I did.
Looks like we got ourselves a reader.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. And now that the 4th of July holiday is in the rearview mirror, it's time to settle in and make the most of what's hopefully not as hectic a summer schedule for you. And if you're not planning to take in that steady stream of air-conditioned summer blockbuster movies, there's a lot to get excited about in the book world. We're going to talk about great fiction reads today. Tomorrow, we'll be on to nonfiction. So, hey, let us know what your favorite nonfiction choices are for the beach or the poolside this summer. You can give us a call at 8778 My Take. We want to hear from you. But first, summer fiction, and who better to tell us about some of the summer's best novels than Ron Charles? He's editor of the Washington Post book section. Ron, welcome to The Takeaway.
It's so nice to be here, Todd.
And it's great to have you. You've got a pretty long list here, and we're going to get to lots of novels that people can curl up with or stretch out with over the summer. I want to start with one on here called A Book of American Martyrs. This one is from Joyce Carol Oates.
Yeah, and it's really explosive. You know, it's based on a terrible murder in Florida in 1994, but she sets it later in Ohio, and it begins with the murder of an abortion doctor by a fundamentalist. And so you think you sort of know where this is going, but you don't, because Joyce Carol Oates is so sympathetic to both sides of this violent debate, and you really get to know this Christian fundamentalist man who's so anguished about what he's feeling and what he's done. And the doctor, of course, who's murdered in the opening pages. But then the novel pursues their children. So what you really follow is the effects of these two men on their families. I just thought it was incredibly engrossing and made me think about the other side of this debate in a way I never had. It's really long. You know, it's almost 800 pages. But if you want a novel that really gets you out of your comfort zone and forces you to think about the other side, no matter which side of this debate you're on, this is it, I think.
And it sounds like there's an incredible amount of realism there. I mean, there are, unfortunately, enough headlines, not only about this debate, but about these types of murders.
Yeah, it's ripped from the headlines in a very specific way, in a very tragic way. And, you know, that debate with the Supreme Court nominations and the way this decision will eventually come down, probably in the next year, this is a book to read to really understand the dimensions of this debate in the country, because I think so many of us are sort of settled on this issue, and we think we know everything about it, and we think we know about the other side, which we have demonized in various ways. And, you know, this does what fiction should do. You know, it makes you uncomfortable. It forces you to live in other people's skin in a way you haven't before. And she's such a spectacularly dramatic, you know, semi-gothic author that it's really, really exciting. I just raced through this book.
You've also been reading a thriller, The 12 Lives of Samuel Hawley by Hannah Tinti.
Yeah, now that's such an unusual thriller, but it's a pretty mild thriller, I would say. It's more of a what we call a literary thriller. It's about a former crook who's trying to get out of the business because he wants to protect his daughter. And so you see him moving to Maine and, you know, trying to get a job in this little fishing community, and it's all very tranquil, and he's got this little girl with him. But then every other chapter tells us about the story about how he got one of his bullet wounds. And those are the 12 lives of Samuel Hawley. It's fun. It's exciting. It breaks up the action with, you know, you've got this the main stories and these older stories of how he was shot in various ways, robberies, murders, other kinds of fraud. I thought it was a really, really engaging and unusual structure for a novel.
You know, often in stories like this, former criminals or people who've done bad things try to leave their past behind. They find it's very difficult to do that. Does crime follow him to Maine?
It definitely does. I don't want to give anything away, but the people that he offended, the people he offended, are desperate to find out where he is and desperate to punish him and his little girl. And that eventually becomes a very dramatic part of the story. It has a kind of a Western flair too, which I kind of liked.
That was not a bid for a spoiler there, just trying to delve in a little bit. Woman number 17 is by Eden Lapucky.
Yeah, this my wife just finished this last night, and she confirmed how much fun it is. It's a very smart, witty novel about childcare and motherhood and art, as it turns out. It's about this woman who gets a contract to write a memoir, but she almost immediately realizes that she doesn't want to write this memoir. So she's procrastinating badly, and she hires a nanny to come take care of her little boy. But the nanny who comes has her own agenda about what she wants to do. And she turns out to be an artist who is working on her own project about her mother. And so it's a lot about mothers and motherhood and childcare and what our responsibilities are to our children and to our own mothers as we, you know, look back. I thought it was a really fun, smart – there's a little touch of Hitchcock there because neither of these women really knows what's going on in this house, and there's some hanky-panky going on with the elder child who's 18, a boy. I think readers will be very surprised and unsettled by this book.
Now, you also go from the domestic there overseas and back in history, I assume, for an Irish immigrant story about a family in Boston. This is Saints for All Occasions.
Yeah, and this is a real sleeper this summer. I think this book is going to sell for a long, long time because I'm hearing from all kinds of people and book clubs about how much they like this book. It's, I mean, J. Courtney Sullivan has had some breakout books before, but this is of a different order. It's a long family story about two sisters who come from Ireland, mid-20th century, settle in Boston. They think they know what their lives are going to be like. But their lives turn out very, very differently. The younger sister, who's a little on the wild side, gets herself in trouble and ends up becoming a nun, a cloistered nun, and lives for decades pretty much in silence away from the rest of her family, while her older sister has a big family and lives that whole, you know, Boston immigrant experience that we've read about before. But in this case, we get to know these children and their lives and these two sisters who have, you know, simmering resentments about what happened to them years ago. It's a really lovely story, the kind of book you just want to be alone with and sink into and read and be transported by.
Well, that's great. Ron Charles, these are some of your new fiction books for summer, kind of first pass books. I wanted to get to an old friend summer read, maybe one that people have read before. You know, for me, I made a mistake the other day. I picked up Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole. I read it 12 times. Then it became 13 because I didn't want to read it and I couldn't put it down. You have Anne Tyler's Saint Maybe on the list here as a great summer read, one that a lot of people may have read before.
Yeah, and frankly, you could pick it. For me, you could pick any book by Anne Tyler. I think she is one of our greatest living writers, and all these books are so beautiful and so funny. But Saint Maybe is the book that really hit me a long time ago when I was starting my own family. If you don't remember it, it's about a teenage boy whose older brother commits suicide, and he ends up deciding to take care of his brother's three children, which, of course, is an enormous decision to make when you're a teenager. He's just 17 years old, and he becomes the saint of the novel. It's a lot about family and our responsibilities to each other. It's everything that Anne Tyler does best, you know, very tender, very funny, very much about quirky family relations and practices and traditions and habits. I think she's just a gem, and this is one of my favorite novels of her to go back to.
Lots of selections for you there from Ron Charles. Your summer reading list for the poolside or the sandy beach this summer, Ron Charles of the Washington Post book section. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Well, for our complete list of summer reading recommendations, be sure to check out our show page at thetakeaway.org. Tomorrow, we bring you some nonfiction titles to crack open, and we do want to hear from you. Tell us what you're reading this summer, fiction or nonfiction, especially tell us your nonfiction choices, and we'll try to get them in the show with your voice as well. 877-8-MY-TAKE is the number. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.